Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, colleagues. Thank you all for coming. My name is Ben Rogers, and I'm a researcher at the University of London and here at LSE Cities. Perhaps more relevant for today's event, I'm a passionate cyclist. I don't wear special gear, I don't have an expensive bike, but cycling is absolutely central to my life and a sort of great source of enjoyment and value. Sorry, I'm very sorry. Okay, there we go. I'm a passionate cyclist. It's central to my life. I get huge value from it. It saves me money. It saves me time. It keeps me fit. It keeps me young. I sort of get back in touch with my 10-year-old self every time I get on a bike. And we know that cycling is really good for people who do it. We also know it's really good for cities and for the planet. Cycling is clean, it's green, it's good for local and urban economies, and it's safer for other road users. And the great thing is we've got, in some ways, a really good story to tell in London about how well we've done in making progress. You know, I'm old enough to remember when cycling was a really minority pursuit, and the central view was it was a crazy thing to be doing in London, the days of cycling were behind us, and we've seen a huge reversal in that. But there is one major issue, and it's the issue we're here to discuss today, one real sort of dark note, which is cycling safety. Around 8 cyclists are killed every year along in London's roads, along with 60 pedestrians and a couple of thousand people seriously injured every year. And I'm very sorry to tell you that we at LSE have lost 3 members of our community in a year. And I just want to begin by commemorating those colleagues now who were killed on London's roads. Adeline Stewart-Watt, who was a policy fellow in the Grantham Institute, killed on the 16th of April, 2023. Gao, who was in our fundraising team in Page, and a young mother who was killed on the 21st of September, 2023. Chiesta Kochlar, who was a PhD student, killed on the 19th of March, 2024. And in that same year, Harry Webb, who was a student at the London College of Contemporary Music, killed on the 12th of September, 2023, which is a terrible, terrible toll. In response to this, staff and students at LSE initiated a cross-university letter to the London mayoral candidates. That's how we first engaged with the Mayor for London and his team. The letter asked candidates to commit to putting a stop to cyclist and pedestrian deaths caused by motor vehicles in London by 2028, and to bring forward the deadline for London's Vision Zero, its strategy to eradicate deaths from London's roads from 2041 to 2032. This event today builds on the letter's demands, as well as being a tribute to our colleagues who were killed. The event will focus on how these goals can be achieved. We've got speakers from academia, from policy making, and urban planning to discuss what can be done to make cycling safer and more inclusive in London, how barriers to implementation can be overcome, and what we can learn from other cities around the world. I'm just going to tell you about how this event will work before I introduce our speakers. So we will hear from each of the speakers in turn. We'll then have a conversation amongst ourselves, but we'll leave at least half an hour for questions and comments from the floor. And if you're listening or joining us online, please also ask your questions, and they'll be forwarded to me. So that's done. Obviously, this is all being broadcast. So let me introduce our speakers. First of all, Rachel Aldridge. Rachel is Professor in Transport at the University of Westminster and Director of the Active Travel Academy. She's a hugely influential authority in the world of active travel. She was awarded the ESRC Outstanding Impact in Public Policy Prize in 2016, and she was also awarded the first annual Westminster University Prize for Research Excellence, so we're very lucky to have her. Online, from the Netherlands, we've got Marco T. Brommelstoet, who is Professor of Urban Mobility Futures at the University of Amsterdam, an academic director of the Lab of Thought. And Marco studies how mainstream narratives influence our mobility system and explores how alternative narratives can expand our understanding of problems and solutions. And he's the co-author of Movement, How to Take Back Our Streets and Transform Our Lives. And there he is. Hi, Marco. Welcome. Will Norman, who became London's first walking and cycling commissioner in 2016, and he leads efforts to make streets safer for walking and cycling, promoting greener and healthier travel. And he was previously director of global partnerships at Nike, and his work focuses on integrating physical activity into daily life. And last, but certainly not least, Julie Plichon, who's head of design and engineering at SASTRANS. That's the UK-wide network which promotes walking and cycling, and is the custodian of the National Cycling Network. And Julie's work focuses on the delivery of people-centered spaces, repurposing road space through the implementation of school streets, low traffic and livable neighborhoods, and similar initiatives. So I think I've set it all out. So I'm gonna just turn to our first speaker, Rachel. And Rachel, my question for you is, based on your research, what does London need to be doing to improve cycling safety?
Great, thank you, Ben. And I'm very pleased to be here today, and thank you for organising the event. So I wanted to say a little bit about both mindset and policies. So in terms of mindset, I think we're probably going to talk about this further, but the framing of road safety has often historically been problematic, and I know it's something that's been discussed a lot in London. So in terms of the main risks to people walking cycling, this is people operating motorised vehicles. Cycling and walking are safe in themselves. They are people walking cycling are at risk because people are driving or operating motor vehicles. And within that framing, what we need to do is, from the research, from the evidence, is kind of fairly clear in principle. Obviously, it's a lot harder in practice. But if the main risk, as it is, to people walking cycling is the use of motor vehicles, well, we need to focus on reducing road danger, which means restricting the use of motor vehicles, which means making sure that people are able to and do use alternatives wherever possible, whether that's personal travel or whether it's freight transport, such as, for instance, last mile deliveries, moving from vans to cargo bikes. You know, every time we shift a person trip or a goods trip away from motorised vehicles to walking, cycling, wheeling, safer modes, then we're doing a tremendous job for safety, for well-being, and so on. So walking and cycling are safe in themselves, but people cycling, people walking are certainly at risk, and they are at an unacceptable risk. We have high levels of deaths and serious injuries, and also high levels of everyday intimidation on the road. So one of the things that I've studied is near misses, which turn out to be the link between injuries and between perceptions of safety. And the rate at which people experience near misses cycling in this country is really unacceptably high. On a weekly basis, people are experiencing fear. And this is important both in itself and because, you know, within a safe systems perspective, we should be treating these kind of incidents as being early warnings, as being something that we should study, because they are signs that danger is present in our system and needs to be reduced. So in terms of the policies, where possible, we should substantially reduce motor traffic volumes and speeds, and that will keep people walking and cycling a lot safer. In London, it's particularly volumes, because often, particularly in central and inner London, motor traffic is already moving quite slowly, but that doesn't mean it's safe or comfortable for people walking and cycling. Where we can't substantially reduce motor traffic speeds or volumes, for instance, on main roads, where we need buses, we need public transport, we need separated high-quality infrastructure for people cycling and for people walking. So my research and other research has shown this needs to be good quality infrastructure. Painting advisory cycle lanes, as historically has been done in this country, it may put people at greater risk. We need good quality infrastructure anywhere we can't substantially reduce motor traffic speeds and volumes. But for much of the network, it's actually reducing the motor traffic that is the key. So I've done quite a lot of research with colleagues into measures like low traffic neighbourhoods, which substantially reduce the amount of motor traffic on primarily residential streets. And we've found some really impressive results in terms of injury reduction. We've done two papers. There's another paper that's currently under peer review. Really large reductions in injuries. The latest paper is also looking at KSIs. So, I mean, maybe it's not surprising, but substantially reducing motor traffic, you know, substantially reduces risk, particularly perhaps for people walking and cycling. And this includes serious injuries. So I think maybe that's going on for 5 minutes. So, I guess, are the main messages. The framing really matters, and the policies, you know, it is about reducing road danger.
I'm not sure that was quite 5 minutes. I'm just going to ask you one small question, which is, are there groups who are particularly vulnerable?
So there was a paper done a few years ago by James Woodcock, Anna Goodman and colleagues that looked at risks to people cycling in central London and found that women were at higher risk than men, and that was particularly related to the risk posed by HGV drivers. It's also worth pointing out that there's links between getting more cycling, getting safer cycling, and getting more inclusive cycling. Because if we look at the preferences that currently underrepresented groups have in cycling, and I would say those underrepresentations are not natural. You know, it's not natural that we have 75% of cyclists being male. This is not the case in the Netherlands. This is not the case in Japan, for instance. But if we look at the preferences of currently underrepresented groups like women, older people, children, and so on, their preferences are strongly in favour of high-quality infrastructure and separation from motor traffic. So we also need to listen to underrepresented groups in terms of what we need.
Thank you very much. And I suppose it's worth mentioning that the three colleagues that we lost here at the LSE were all women. Will, you're at the very centre of this, leading on this for the Mayor. How does safety for cyclists and active travel fit into the Mayor's strategy for London? And what have you achieved so far? And what are the main ingredients of London's current plan to eliminate deadly accidents by 2040?
So I would say fairly central to the plans, and not just the transport plans. This fits into the environmental plans, our economic plans, our housing plans. The importance of having a livable city, a city in which people are safe on our roads, but also don't have the risk of breathing in toxic air, that where we have a city where people want to come and live and work, is vital for the future success of London more broadly. So, as Rachel said, the fear of being injured on the roads is the biggest barrier to stopping that shift that we need to see from people using the motor vehicles to more walking, to more cycling, and of course public transport, which is a vital part of that that conundrum. But it is that those figures, those individuals who have been killed, really highlight the problem that we're facing. And every death and every serious injury on our roads is a tragedy. Part of my job is actually meeting people who've suffered in collisions, or have lost loved ones in collisions. And the more people I see in that respect, the more I refuse to accept that this is an inevitable part of moving around our city. Deaths and serious injuries on our roads is not an inevitable part of urban living. And the consequences of this, they're often violent deaths. They're traumatic. They leave trauma not just for those people who've been directly affected, but their family, their friends, their colleagues, as we've heard here at LSE, and in wider communities. And that has a lasting impact that goes way beyond the individual lives of those people. It also affects the health of those communities in terms of the ability of kids to be able to play out, in terms of those social interactions that come from people walking, cycling around those local communities. And that's why the Mayor and I are absolutely committed to making our streets safer, absolutely committed to our approach, which we've adopted, which is a safer systems approach, which, as Rachel said, is Vision Zero. Borrowing and learning from other cities around the world, Stockholm, Copenhagen, Norway, so Oslo, Helsinki, around the world, taking that approach which says we are aiming to eliminate deaths and serious injuries on our roads by 2041. That is an ambitious goal. That is a challenge. As you pointed out, there were 95 people killed on London streets last year, 3,615 seriously injured on our roads. But it is possible, and the approach that we're taking on that, the Vision Zero strategy hinges on four key pillars. The first pillar on that is, as Rachel alluded to, is how do we make our streets safer? How do we actually provide the safer space for people to be able to choose those active travel options? That since 2016, we've seen a 450% increase in our cycle network around the city and introduced quality criteria to make sure that actually where there is a busy road, it needs to be protected infrastructure. If it is a quieter road, it actually needs to be a quieter road and filtered to achieve that level of thing. We've seen the delivery of over 100 low-traffic neighbourhoods around the city that are enabling more people to walk and cycle safely around the city. We've tackled over 45 of London's most dangerous junctions on the main strategic arteries. There are hundreds of pedestrian crossings and cycle crossings that have gone on, and over 600 school streets that have happened. But it's not just about that safe infrastructure. The second pillar is also about reducing speeds on London roads. About half the fatalities on London roads are associated with speeds. We have to slow down the traffic. In central London, speeds are usually slow during the day. That's not true at night, and it certainly isn't true across the whole city. About 52% of London's roads are now 20-mile-an-hour zones, and everybody should be aware that if you are hit by a vehicle travelling at 20 miles an hour, you're five times more likely to survive that collision than if it's hit at 30. Slower speeds save lives, and the latest data is showing that a 25% fall in fatal collisions because of the lower speeds, certainly on the TFL roads. So you've got the safer roads, you've got the safer speeds. But we also need safer behaviour. We fund the Road Traffic Police Task Force, the police command for making our streets safer. That's about enforcement, reducing the amount of dangerous driving that exists in our city. We have built the capacity of that group to enforce up to a million speeding enforcement things. I think when we started this, there was about 160,000. Now, my wish is not to issue 160,000 tickets. None of that money comes to us. It all goes to government. It's not a money-making exercise. Frankly, it'd be brilliant if we didn't issue a single one, because that would indicate that nobody is speeding. But we are a very, very long way from that. So we've got the safer streets, we've got the safer speeds, we've got the safer behaviour, but safer vehicles and embracing technology is really important. How do we use that new technology? I don't believe that there will be autonomous vehicles driving around London's streets anytime now soon, but I do believe the amount of R&D that's gone into that all those car companies and everybody investing it, we can take some of that technology and make our vehicles safer. Every new London bus that is bought for in London is not just zero emission, but has automated speed limiters to make that safer, and we're retrofitting it onto our fleet. Rachel mentioned heavy goods vehicles. Heavy goods vehicles have historically been disproportionately involved in more collisions than anyone else. I think when I started, about 50% of the cycling fatalities involved a collision with an HGV. I think about 25% of the pedestrian fatalities involved a collision with an HGV. Part of the reason for that is, for some mad reason, we design our trucks where the drivers can't see all the way around it. So in London, we brought in the world's first direct vision standard, where you measure the amount of vision a truck driver has, and if the truck hasn't got a required level on that, they have to fit sensors and cameras around that. We have seen a 62% reduction in fatalities since that was introduced in 2019, but we've just, what day is it today? It's Halloween. So on the 28th, we introduced the second phase of that, which upped the standards and brought in the latest technology. So you need safer streets, you need safer speeds, you need safer behaviour, but you also need safer vehicles and what we can do on that side of things. What's the impact of all of this? We have seen cycling increase. I think there are now 1.26 million cycle trips in London. On a daily basis, That's bucking the national trend. Since COVID, we've seen cycling continue to increase, whereas nationally we've seen that fall. Fatalities and risk is down. We've seen, I think, a 30% fall in overall fatalities and a 40% fall against fatalities in cycling. The fatalities are falling four times faster in London than nationwide. But this is nowhere near enough. This is just not enough. As I go back to the point, every single one of those deaths and injuries is a tragedy and brings devastation to people's lives. There is so much more to do. There's so much more to learn from other cities. London is not homogenous in this. The strange system of governance we've got means that some boroughs are really going leaps and bounds and really pursuing this, others far less, and we are seeing the risk fall in those areas with safe infrastructure, and where the changes are happening, risk isn't falling where that isn't there. So we have an awful long way to go. I'm looking forward to this evening because I want to learn as much as I can from everyone's expertise to be able to tackle this problem.
But hand on heart, do you think we're going to get to the 2040 target, and can you bring it forward?
I don't think we can bring it forward, but I hope we can get there. I'd do everything possible.
What's the one thing that needs to change? Is it the governance of London? Is it the resources? Is it
all of the above? I think the fact that we've got 34 different highway authorities managing London's roads. The fact that the mayor, I think, is only responsible 5% of London's roads is a challenge. The fact that there is limited resourcing at the moment for transport more broadly, the way that transport is funded in London, I think, is a challenge. But I think this goes way beyond just those technical things. I think this is actually addressing decades of design of our city around the motor vehicle. I think it's decades of billions of pounds being invested in, from the car industry and others, in the concept that cars somehow equal freedom, cars somehow equal, there is a cultural change that needs to happen in London, and that needs leadership at all levels, in the community, in academia, in politics, in business, in the health service. Everybody has, in universities, everybody has a role to play in this. It's not easy, but I think collectively together we can do it. We can make a difference, and we're already seeing the changes happening in London already.
Brilliant. Okay, well, we'll turn after to Julie. Really, just a question about the relationships between safety and getting more people to cycle. I mean, would it be enough simply to dramatically reduce death and road injuries, or are there other barriers that are stopping people from cycling? And yeah, how should we understand this sort of relationship?
Thank you very much for the question around increasing diversity in cycling. So first of all, at SusTrans, we obviously really embrace the Mayor's Vision Zero, and we work alongside TfL and the local authorities to deliver their vision. But so I'm going to talk you through the behaviour change framework that we use at SusTrans, and bear with me with the acronym. I'm going to explain how we achieve greater diversity in cycling. So what we use at SusTrans is called the COMBI model. So bear with me again, the acronym. So B stands for behaviour, C for capability, O for opportunity, and M for motivation. So the first step is the capability. So it's really, can you ride a bicycle? So it's about the skills and the training. So really the first step in the model. The O stands for the opportunity, and it's about the environment, the way our city and our built environment is organized. So it's really about the infrastructure, ultimately. And I'm going to delve a bit more into this because I obviously work in design engineering. The N is the motivation. So this is really things from, this is quite a broad category, so things like, if you get to your destination, do you have cycle parking to put your bike in a safe and secure space? If you've just done a long cycle, is there an opportunity to change or to take a shower? So these are the end of trip facilities. But there's also, and that's where you go into the kind of cultural and social element, are there also the role models, the people who look like you and who are already on wheels, or also the type of bicycles or beyond the bicycle? So thinking about the tricycles for people who might require some support in terms of their balance, or family mobility, cargo bikes, and so on. So that motivation element is really, really crucial. So now I just want to talk a bit about the kind of like challenge and the opportunity that we have in our beautiful capital, which is, you know, London is quite unique because it's a city that has grown from being a collection of medieval villages into the cosmopolis that we know today. So it's very different from other European capitals in that respect. And I really want to talk about the opportunity, the environment and the infrastructure, and looking at the geometry in particular. So this is comparing three great European cities. The first one is Barcelona. So typically, and I've really looked at typical inner distributor roads in all three cities. In Barcelona, you would have about 48 meters building to building, and that helps you achieving what we call a complete street. So you can achieve all, you can basically accommodate all of the modes of transport. Everyone has their own space, so you can have your cycle tracks that are separated from the rest of the movement. You can have your bus priority, and you can have even more than movement. You can also have, place interventions like outdoor seating, things that help you combat climate change, things that we call sustainable urban drainage systems, increasing tree canopy, and so on. In Paris, you have a bit less space, so you have 26 or 27 meters in this example here on Boulevard Voltaire. So that kind of like forces you to make some choices here. So in that example, for instance, there is no bus priority, but you still have the cycle tracks. There is some parking, that parking could go, and then you can choose to prioritize the buses. But that kind of like, you know, brings to the, really this question of making choices in the way you accommodate all those movements. In London, and this is the example of Borough High Street, you have 18 meters. So 18 meters is already really challenging in terms of just accommodating all these movements. So on that particular street, we have bus priority and we have general traffic lanes as well as pavements, which are really not that wide. So what happens here is that if you're cycling, you're going to end up cycling in the bus lane, which, you know, means that you are dealing with less volumes of traffic than if you are in the general traffic lane. However, if you're thinking of inclusivity and really designing for everybody, is hugely problematic, and certainly would put some people off, and you know those near misses, but also the casualties and the fatalities involving bus and coaches is a real issue in London. So that's kind of like the beauty of our city. The distributor roads are not wide enough, but that opens up opportunities. And as Rachel and Will have touched on, I think, you know, the low traffic neighborhood approach, the kind of area-wide traffic reduction is really the kind of way you can implement alternative networks that provide that cycle infrastructure. So cycle infrastructure is not just cycle tracks, it's also these quieter networks that you deliver through neighborhoods. But just to kind of build on the points that have been made earlier, I think you can only really achieve that diversity if also you provide people with, that goes back to the capability of the combi model, with basically the cycle skills and especially the kind of the route mapping to go through those low traffic neighborhoods, because they are not as direct as main roads. So to go from A to B along a network of low traffic neighborhoods, you actually need to know your way around. The reality is, like, Google Maps is of no use when it comes to identifying those quiet routes. So if there are any web developers in the room, please apply to Google Maps right now and improve their navigation. But really, the wayfinding, the route mapping, and like basically the culture of being able, and just the knowledge of being of knowing the routes around the capital is what will ultimately make cycling more diverse.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you very much. I mean, so would it be perhaps lots of ways of measuring this, but how much less safe is London than Paris or Barcelona? Do you have any way of talking about that or estimating that?
Well, I would say that, I don't know the figures of safety. I know that, for instance, in terms of gender split, Paris is certainly, and France in general, is more gender balanced than the UK and London. Paris has transformed itself over the past 5 years. The quality of the cycle infrastructure has really kind of taken off. It's incomparable to what it was 10 years ago. But you can see, I think, the diversity in the profile of people cycling in Paris has changed, you know, like from family mobility and so on. And that comes directly from the reduction in traffic volumes and the cycle infrastructure on these kind of key arterial routes. In Barcelona, obviously, you have a grid system, so it's very easy, in terms of the navigation. But those, again, are complemented by the famous super blocks. So it's a bit like the low traffic neighborhoods. It relies on the principle of modal filtering.
But the sort of headline there really is London is a much more complex challenge than it would be in those other cities.
I think a medieval urban grain is a real challenge. That's a reality. It's the beauty and the challenge of it.
Okay, Marco. Over to you. Now, you've just published a blog on the LSE website about where we should stop working on improving road safety. Do you want to talk a bit about that and also about just other cities from which London can learn?
Yes. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It really feels to my bones to hear about the terrible loss in your institution, but I also feel very honored to be part of this incredible panel of people together today to talk about this. Indeed, today is Halloween. Halloween is a day which is completely predictable, the most deadly day in the lives of children in the UK on their own streets. After leaving school today, the risk of a child being killed or seriously injured by a car jumps by 34%. So my comments to this are generic because I want to reinforce the things that all have already been said on stage, but I want to have a sort of a general reflecting on how we talk about how we frame traffic safety. So what if I tell you that the keys that we are looking at here in the picture are standing on a very dangerous spot? And what if I ask you to save all of the keys? What would you do? What would your key strategy be? Look carefully. How can you save them? Would you lure them away with food, scare them away by shouting, or maybe offer them more protection? Instead of human tragedies, our newspapers report traffic violence as an undesirable glitch in the traffic machine, dehumanized nuisance for a general functioning in which the effects on traffic are often more important than the impact on the people involved. And not only in newspapers, but also in traffic safety statistics, in traffic safety campaigns, our attention automatically goes to saving lives, vision zero, by instructing the victims. Wear a helmet, make sure to be seen. Look left, right, left before you cross. And we'd like to focus on individual behavior. Don't drink and drive, don't be distracted, and please try not to speed if you don't mind. Next slide, please.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
But what if we really want to work on solutions? Back, please. Then we need to shift our focus to the real danger. I ask you to look at the geese, but instead we are missing the fox in the tree. We should focus on taking away the danger instead of weaponizing the victims. We could limit speed around schools, as London is already doing. We could develop living streets. We could have playgrounds where children should be able to flourish. We could reduce the amount of cars. We could reduce their size, their weight, their speed, their acceleration. And we could reduce the distraction behind the wheel. We could create public spaces where we want to enjoy ourselves without constantly worrying about our safety. We should focus on the fox in the tree and not only focusing on saving the geese. Allowing them to scurry around carefree, that should be our goal. Next slide, please. So, how did we get here? Well, long story short, our streets used to serve many different goals, also in London, but now they have become mainly places that serve for vehicular throughput. Based on the language of water engineering, the language of biology, and the language of the Homo economicus, our traffic engineers spent the last decade making our public spaces places from places of justice to places of efficiency, control, and the freedom of individual car drivers. It took them decades, but now this thinking has solidified our streets, our thinking, and our imagination. Next slide, please. We've learned to see road safety in terms of cold statistics. We collect those statistics, add up categories that are similar from the point of efficiency, but categories that are completely morally incompatible in terms of justice. We group people that die with people that kill each other, and we put it all together. Our statistics tell us everything about the victims. but very little about the systemic nature of the causes. We talk about accidents between vehicles 70 times a day in the Netherlands, every day. Statistics that give the impression that traffic violence is a natural phenomenon that we simply have to face, in which people succumb and suddenly cross the road. Statistics that allow us to put it in models, to put it in trade-offs, and to see if it actually measures out with travel time savings. Next slide, please. Traffic crashes are presented as vicious in a machine, dehumanizes interferences with the overall functioning of a well-oiled machine, where effects on traffic flow prompt the impact on the people involved, instead of human tragedy that they present for all those involved. Statistics, in other words, that make us believe that the only thing we can do is stay alive, with scientific organizations, annual traffic safety summits, the International Cycling Safety Conference, behavioral campaigns, and traffic safety officials. We institutionalized traffic safety training even for children from the age of 4 that teach them the discipline of road safety. Next slide, please. Kohler already stated that the naturalization and denial of vehicular violence has allowed car deaths to become largely invisible relative to their horrific ubiquity, shielding it from any subsequent ubiquitous day. Through these choices, we are guilty. We are guilty of normalizing the danger itself. Instead, we need to start looking the monster in the eye, stop trying to increase road safety, and head on working on decreasing road danger. We know where the danger comes from. While we were busy with teaching people road safety, the danger increased in size, weight, speed, acceleration, and distractions behind the wheel. We know it. And still, so often, we do not talk about it. But we must. The only acceptable answer to the question, if you can bring the 2040 goal forward, would always be yes, because it would be in any other domain of our lives. Thanks.
I want to pick up, first and foremost, this question of HGVs. My personal sort of interest. I mean, I'm just struck. I cycle to work every morning. I'm amazed at what I see in the roads in terms of large HGVs, you know, articulated, going through London at rush hour with kids at their feet, with a single driver. I'm always so amused because then when you see them moving into a building site, the whole policy regime completely changes. Suddenly they're not allowed to travel at more than 4 miles an hour. Somebody moves in front of them with a high-vis jacket. There's two people behind them with high-vis jackets. Why are we allowing these huge HGVs, even with the extra precautions that you've put in, to move through our streets in this way?
I think for the city to function, we're a city of 9 million people, another million people come in every day. The one thing that is always happening in London is change. It's the guaranteed certainty of change, isn't it? So there is always building work. For the economy to function, there need to be those deliveries, there needs to be the removal of waste. What we have seen is the number of HGVs plateauing. The number of vans, however, continue to increase. And we go back to the issue of the volume of traffic. It's not just the type of traffic, it's also the volume of traffic. To service the city and to run the city, we do need a freight component. But you're absolutely right, we need to make it safer. There is a, you know, the building sites weren't always like that. Yeah, not all of them still like that. In Camden, someone was killed last year at a building site where that didn't happen, but that was as a result of the regulations that were brought in to make those turning movements safer and that side of things. The trucks are getting safer in London. The number of fatalities are reducing, but I cannot envisage a world where we don't have the HGVs in London. We need to reduce the mileage that they do. So, for example, the construction traffic, I found out to some horror that actually you find trucks driving around London while they are waiting to be loaded and while they are waiting to move materials around. So increasingly, we're using other building sites as places so that they stop. So you reduce the mileage of those in spaces. There is increasing use of that last mile delivery, and how do you do freight consolidation? So, for example, on Bond Street, there used to be, I think, 149 vehicle movements associated with rubbish, yeah? Because every business had its own just contract with a with a lorry company picking stuff up. Those businesses work together and reduce that to 9 vehicle movements a day, with associated savings in safety in terms of NOx emissions, CO2 emissions, etc. You can see the growth in cargo bikes that are happening in London. It's remarkable the changes that are happening. You just need to spend some time out in the bike lanes, see the changes that are happening there. You look at what the NHS are doing. Guys and St Tommy's have now got a freight consolidation centre out by Heathrow. What drove that was not actually the number of vehicles, it was the number of nurses that were needed to unload and move stuff around, and it was a sort of traditional time motion study on actually what a waste of resources this was. We have to make freight work better in the city. We need the vehicles to be safer, we need fewer of them, but ultimately I can't envisage a world where you wouldn't have some, because London is dependent on that change, our economy functions on it, is why we're here. So the challenge is, how do we make our roads safer, protect cyclists from where they are near those trucks, the protected cycleways, the low traffic neighbourhoods, the navigation through those areas for people. We need the trucks themselves to be safer. We need fewer of them. We need the alternatives. But I can't envisage a time in the foreseeable future where we won't have any HGVs working in the city at all.
I'm going to ask one more question, then I'm going to ask our other colleagues to respond to everything they've heard, which is about the future of new micromobilities, electric vehicles. Have we got the regulation right? Are they, as many people believe, posing a sort of threat to road safety?
Absolutely not. The regulation is, this is a prime example where you've seen technology develop very quickly and the regulation lag behind. One of the challenges in regulation, though, is who's got the power to regulate, and where do those powers sit? So I think that micromobility offers a whole raft of opportunities. You look at the growth of e-bikes in other European cities. You look at the growth of e-bikes in this city. You've seen increasing the diversity, increasing the distance, increasing the ethnic diversity, the age. It's a radical transformation. I'm yet to see someone get on an e-bike and not smile within 2 or 3 minutes of being on one. But those being parked all over the pavements is absolutely abhorrent. It's wrong. The challenge around e-bike fires and the safety qualities of the batteries and the charging systems is a significant challenge and problem. And I've met people who've sadly lost loved ones in those fires. We need to embrace the new technology, but we need the powers, and cities across the UK need the powers to regulate that. We need the powers to mandate and regulate the quality of the products themselves, whether that's the batteries, the chargers, the brakes, the speed, all of that sort of things. You can't have these, 50 miles. I was with the police. I was watching a video the police showed me of a cop car going down the A12, and they were sitting, you could see the speedo in the dash cam, and it was sitting at 50. And then suddenly, an e-scooter, a private e-scooter went past them going down the A12. For those of you who don't know the A12, it's a 3-lane motorway going out east. The language that went in that cop car was, I won't repeat it here, but obviously they put on their blues and twos, as they call it, and pulled that individual over. But the fact that that is even available to buy and modify is wrong. So we need to embrace the benefits of micromobility. Particularly e-bikes and e-scooters have a role in the urban environment, but they need to be safe for everybody. They need to be safe for pedestrians. They need to be safe with people with visual impairments. They need to be safe for people in buggies. Parking them all over the pavement is not the case. But it's an example where national legislation has lagged behind for far too long, actually, the advances in technology. And we need to get that right.
Rachel, do you want to respond to anything you've heard?
It's kind of interesting. I was just musing on, and I guess it's a slight challenge for Will, the contrast between you're talking about regulations in terms of micromobility and the HGV side of things. So I'm just thinking about the HGV side of things, because Ben, as you were talking about, clearly the HGV companies and the freight companies, they don't have to pay the full costs. We're paying the costs of the fact that they can travel across London in that way, pushing costs onto others, as was previously done and as is, you know, sadly still sometimes done on building sites, on construction sites. So basically they're putting their costs, they're externalising their costs onto other people. And I do think we should envisage radical futures, even if we don't think they're going to happen immediately, I guess. And the problem with freight, so I know a little bit about freight, it's not my core area, but I have colleagues that research it. And when I read the freight literature, I'm so frustrated because the lack of data, there's always limited good examples, right? There's always a street, there's always a company, there's always a hospital that where they've done something. But overall, as has been acknowledged, the van trips, the use of vans is going up despite these isolated good examples. And that's been the case, like, nationally for cycling for quite some time, you know, and we're not getting it right because there are isolated good examples. But the overall picture is not changing. And so, you know, you also get into lock-in. So the fact that you get, you know, in theory, there are certainly parts of central inner London where business is changing from vans for deliveries to cargo bikes might be rational, but there's lock-in. That's not going to happen without a push, and we know that businesses can be quite, you know, can change quite quickly if they know regulations coming in. They will complain about it, they will complain and complain about it, and then they will change because they know that they have to. And I guess my question, the other point I wanted to make as well is that HGV and van driving jobs, you know, you may be safe in an HGV, driving an HGV or van, but you're not healthy. These are unhealthy jobs for the people who do them as well, and they're often jobs on poor conditions. There was the classic epidemiological studies showing that bus conductors were a lot healthier than bus drivers because they got the physical activity. Now we've abolished the conductors' jobs and kept the drivers' jobs, which I think is also illustrative. But my question for Will is, I guess, you know, we need more systematic change around the freight, you know, even if we acknowledge that there will be HGVs on the street for some time. We need this systematic, more radical change. And are the things that TfL and the mayor would like to do but are not able to do, are the changes in national national regulations, are the ways in which London would like to be more bold around freight, around ensuring that freight does decarbonise, become healthier and safer, that you can't currently do? What would you like to do?
So I think, in our defence, we've been the one city in the UK, if not around the world, has actually done anything about this space, particularly around the direct vision standard side of things. And I'm genuinely proud of that. We've seen a difference in that. We also were the ones who pioneered clocks and fours, that side of things. It's madness that all of these regulations, vehicle regulations, are coming out of a single city. Yep. That the fact that we've pushed all of that is happening. This needs to be happening. Vehicle regulations need to happen at a national level. One of the problems I'm seeing now is that because London is attracting, because we've got regulations in place, you're seeing the more unsafe vehicles going to other cities in London. The way that freight services are being managed now means that people are bringing the safest vehicles into London because they know they'll get fined £550 a day for not bringing it in. So that is, I think, an example, but this has to be joined up, and I think this is one of the challenges in the UK, that how do we actually make sure that all our cities are working on this in terms of that, in terms of, you know, the urban transport group, etc.
So you're saying that London is doing enough, but the rest of the UK should be doing
the same?
I'm not
saying we're doing enough, but I think everybody else needs to step up, and I think that would help everybody.
Can I just throw, like, you know, an additional consideration, again, thinking about the city spatially? And I think for me, you know, safeguarding industrial space is part of the answer as well. We have seen an erosion of industrial land in London, and that's through deregulation and, like, the lack of protections around land use, and that increases mileage as well. So industrial sites which are located, you know, around inner London, for instance, which ultimately reduce our mileage, are going. And we see that in Islington, a local authority where I used to work, for instance, and many other sites. So I think the protection of that industrial land, and, like, allowing also those vehicles to park somewhere, and that requires land, I think is also vital.
Can we hear Marco? Marco, can you hear us now? Can we hear you?
No. We can't.
Are you on mute, or we just can't hear you? No. I'm Sorry about this. Okay. Oh.
Say something again, Marco.
No. Can hear you very faintly.
No, this is not. Maybe he can send through some questions or comments. And the question about do you have views on micromobilities and the new electronic technologies?
I think it's really interesting. I think micromobilities are a really, really great way of getting people out of cars, which is, you know, ultimately what we all want, I think, here. I might be going on a tangent here, but, you know, there is a trend around what we call kind of like motor obesity or car obesity, you know, like SUVs kind of taking over our streets. And maybe there is a similar trend with, you know, like fat bikes and like these kind of like larger cycles and these e-bikes going ever more, you know, like fast, basically, and becoming another category of vehicle almost. And I think that these need to be considered separately to what we call cycles, essentially. So I don't really have an answer. I'm just thinking that there is a trend of larger vehicles in all categories. So, you know, we do need to address that.
I was talking to colleagues in the Netherlands, you know, and again, I think it's a learning from everybody, and that same challenge of the fat bikes, the souped-up e-bikes, and how those, you know, we can't tackle this as a city, we can't tackle this as a country, but we do need to tackle this as a region, because goods that come into Rotterdam and get, you know, a crate, a shipping container of... what are technically illegal vehicles coming into Rotterdam.
Technically
so illegal. Yeah, illegal. So some of those are, and the challenge that they're facing in the Netherlands and of either souped up, too big, too fast, and I think that they then pose, certainly in the UK, where some parts of micromobility are not embedded in, we still see there is a risk to individuals in terms of the risk of collisions, but there's a wider risk to micromobility full stop, with the way that these things are then seen as dangerous. Good quality e-bikes that conform to the existing regulations and standards are not dangerous. They are good, they're safe, they're also good for people's health. You get 80% of the level of physical activity of an e-bike, a cardiologist was telling me. This is vital for the shift that we need to see in our city, is exactly what you're saying, away from cars to other alternatives. But some of the lack of regulation in this space and the lack of and the challenges around enforcement and the new products coming in here pose a threat to that overall positive piece that could actually benefit the wider cities, not just in London, but across all of Europe.
Rachel, anything to say on the e-bikes? And...
I think there's some good evidence on that e-bikes are going to substantially extend the range of people cycling, diversify the amount of people cycling, and I'm glad to see that. That is increasingly being recognised. They will help us diversify cycling if the conditions are there to support that.
So. You still need the safe streets, though. Yes. If it's an e-bike or non-an e-bike, you still need the protected cycle lanes, the quieter roads, and that still continues to be the risk.
Marco, can you hear us now?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Okay.
No? No.
I'm going to take some questions from the floor, and then I really do hope that we can to fix this at some point. We can get through. Okay, lots of questions. I'm going to start at the back. Gentleman here, yep. Blue sweater, glasses, that's you. I'll take a couple. I'm going to take three at a time. Okay.
Thank you. So there was a comment on behavior, and as a cyclist, I feel safe as other motorists.
Can you hold your mic a bit closer?
So as cyclists, I guess we feel safe as other if motorists and other participants in the traffic respect us. So I was wondering whether you have thoughts on how the changing demographic of cyclists has changed the obeyance with the observance of traffic laws, and in particular the rental bikes and the delivery services seem to adopt a much more open style to traffic violations. So I was wondering how that has impacted the overall enforcement of traffic laws on the streets of London, and how that could be enforced better, in particular by the local metropolitan police.
About enforcement. I'll take one more question from the back. The gentleman over here.
Hi, I was wondering what you can do about the patchwork of authorities in London that you were talking about. So how you can stop the cycle lanes stopping as soon as you get to Chelsea, or the, or them being taken out in Tower Hamlets so that you can actually cycle around the whole of the city.
Yeah, and I guess what other, I know, are the barriers there, the politics, or is it funding, or what is it? I'll take one more. Do we have any women who want to ask? There's a woman who wants to ask a question. Very good, in blue there. I will come back.
Which one? Could you pass?
So I was actually going to ask exactly the same question in terms of the different authorities, but specifically with the political bent. You've just been elected with a very green mandate and a promise to tackle cycling and improving active travel in London. But each of the local authorities is facing a local election within 18 months, and we can already sense that they are all getting very scared of that hill of hysteria at the plans of the next LTN or the next cycle lane or the next parklet going in. How can you help them? How can you provide them with the fig leaf from the mayor's office to give them the courage to keep making the changes that they know they need to do, but that, frankly, they are just all collectively far too scared to do?
Great question. Okay, so we've got some questions about the sort of politics of all this, the electoral politics, about, related to that, I suppose, is the boroughs and what we can do to encourage perhaps the boroughs who are a bit more recalcitrant, and a question about, which you touched on earlier, about the policing of, particularly of electric bikes. I mean, I'm looking at you, but I'm very happy. Well, I take responsibility.
Someone else go first. I'm very happy to talk about it. Well, I can start on the politics, but Rachel, do you want to?
I mean, I can say something. I can say maybe something, first of all, about the cyclists' behaviour as well. And I think I'm kind of quite worried about the potential stigmatisation of delivery cyclists. Delivery cyclists often have really poor working conditions. They often, you see them, I used to live in Hackney, you would see them congregating outside the McDonald's. They had nowhere to go. They were standing outside. They were treated very badly. They earned very low wages. And, you know, I think these people deserve good jobs, deserve good paying conditions. They're doing a really important service. They're also disproportionately ethnic minority men. And I think, we should look at improving their pay conditions rather than over-policing them. I would also say that this is a slightly wider point as well. Some of the work that I've done that I haven't had time to mention with other academics around risk to others. So framing reframing road safety as road danger, I think, is really important, and looking at the risk that different modes pose to others. And I'm really pleased that the Department for Transport now reports on this regularly. TfL does periodically, but I think could do a little bit more. And one of the things, so some of the analysis that I've done has looked at risk to others by mode, and we can see, for instance, that motorcyclists and HGV drivers pose a particularly high risk to other road users. But I've also looked at age and gender, and it's quite interesting when you look at, there's really substantial benefits of getting men onto bikes rather than, you know, operating motor vehicles. And if, honestly, we should not, I mean, I do wonder about it, right? Male HGV drivers pose four times the risk to others per kilometre as female HGV drivers. The gap for motorcycling is even greater. And I do think this is not part of the discussion. I feel it should be. Why are these jobs disproportionately done by men? And actually the benefits, you know, whenever I'm tempted to be annoyed at a young man cycling in a slightly risky manner, I think, well, thank goodness he's not in a motorbike and a car and they should be. It's a serious point, though. Think about the fact that you're reducing risk, harm reduction. You know, this is a known approach.
I really can't agree more. I'm so glad they're not on a motorcycle or an SUV doing their delivery. And same point really about the working conditions. I think just in reiterating, you know, in the data also, you know, the collisions and the KSI, they're not created by people on bikes. It's overwhelmingly from motor vehicles. So I think we need to kind of go back to the data there as well to identify where the real problem is. I guess something around the local authorities, you know, there was a kind of like a prep question, which we haven't gotten to, which was kind of like, how do we avoid the bike clash, you know? And I think it's not so much about how communities react to active travel schemes. In fact, the last local election was really a seal of approval for those local authorities that have been built with active travel schemes. and a bit of, you know, international example. After a successful trip to Copenhagen, the mayor of Ljubljana, the capital city of Slovenia, back in the mid-noughties, got back to the city and decided to pedestrianize pretty much the whole of the city center. Approval rate, 90% of people against the plans. He went ahead and implemented his vision. 10 years later, 95% of support for what had been done. So I think it's really like, you know, it's about emboldening politicians in doing that kind of, you know, very kind of delivering this type of ambitious vision. I think really for the gaps between the local authorities, obviously, I think, you know, many administrations get elected with a manifesto, and then the manifesto isn't actually implemented because of the fear again of that backlash. So many really great transport strategies that never actually really get implemented. There is also, I think, an internal thing, and maybe that's something to take away from well, but you know, within TfL, sometimes there are different stances around the real benefits or the real at least potential of traffic evaporation when we put in an LTN in place. And I think concerns sometimes around traffic impact on internal strategic roads or even bus journey times, which sometimes can, you know, create difficult conversations in terms of implementing more low traffic neighborhoods. So, you know, I think we need to kind of come to a bit more common ground within TfL as well, and, you know, maybe rely not so much on traffic modeling as an industry, and just kind of like go ahead, implement, and then monitor and see what happens. I think we need to do a bit more of that.
Right.
On the behaviour, I totally agree with Rachel on stigmatising certain groups, and particularly the delivery drivers, but also HGV drivers. I've been out with HGV drivers. Driving an HGV around London is exceptionally stressful. Mm-hmm. You know, this is and it is a vital part of our economy, whether we like it or not, and we all depend on it at the moment, and that is difficult. So we shouldn't be stigmatising any particular groups, but we also need to recognise there is actually terrible behaviour from all groups. You know, some people act like, well, the way I wanted to do it was frame a campaign saying, don't be a dick, yeah? Where if you're driving a car, don't be a dick. If you're driving a truck, don't be a dick. If you're cycling, don't be, you know? It's like, don't go through red lights, don't put people at, like, slow down and stop at zebra crossings. This is basic civility. You know, treat other people how you want to be treated yourselves. And I think collectively, we all have a role to play in that. Peer pressure and social networks.
Can we come to this? Because my question, where is the awareness problem? You never see a sign in the tool to advise you as a driver, to advise as a cyclist or a pedestrian. You are correct.
Okay, I'm going to repeat that question because...
Let me come on to that.
But I won't...
University public announcements on TV, university public announcements on radio. So we all talk about infrastructure, but where is the...
It's a very good point. All I'm saying is our online audience won't be able to hear you, so I'm just going to make sure we play that question back.
Can I come on to that?
Yeah.
Because I think it's a very valid point. So I do think there is a need for enforcement. There is of all drivers who, if you're driving a bike, a bus, a truck, a car, dangerous behaviour should not be tolerated on the roads, and that is irrespective of what mode of transport you are using. It's why, again, we do fund the road traffic policing that also enforces against cyclists as well as it enforcing against cars. But we also have to recognise where the risk lies, and far more people, as that slide that Marco showed on the streets, that pedestrians across all of Europe, I think, killed 10 pedestrians were killed by cyclists on that road. And you look at the numbers for people who are hit by cars, et cetera, that is in the thousands that follows through in London. So there is certainly an issue with behaviour, and I think that's collectively we all need to play a role in that. But it is, you know, I don't want to stigmatise any particular group. I think that's across, and that's just down to the bad behaviour. On the issue of politics, don't bash the boroughs. The boroughs have delivered an astonishing amount across London, and are actually key for delivering change in our city. 95% of London's roads are run by boroughs, and you can see some of the changes that are happening with the progressive boroughs that have adopted this agenda historically, whether that be in Camden or Waltham Forest or Enfield or in Hackney. You can see the amazing work that's happening in Lambeth at the moment. Southwark are doing stuff, Newham are doing more and more things. You can see a change happening across the city. The boroughs are vital delivery partners in this. But you're absolutely right, there is a patchwork of this. And I think You know, it's an odd way to set up a transport system in a city, to divide the city the way we've got. I, before this job, had no idea where one borough started and one borough stopped. And some bits I still get confused. And often the borough boundaries are the hardest bits to tackle. One borough's traffic reduction scheme seems to be loading it onto a neighbouring borough. And that is part of the challenge of working in the city. We can't change the governance structure as it stands, so we work with them. The good news, I think, is the number of boroughs that are delivering continues to expand. If you look at the sort of coalition of the willing who are actually delivering high-quality infrastructure in London 8 years ago, it was a, you know, it was pocketed, but actually you can, it was a small pocket. That is growing, and more boroughs are beginning to put their feet in the door, wanting to take risks to do that. And the electoral, as somebody pointed out earlier, the electoral numbers add up on this. You're absolutely right. Sadiq was elected for a third time on the second biggest majority ever. And that was breaking his first election on this. This does work. People want to see these changes that are happening on the streets. The electoral politics show that. And the more people recognise that, the more it emboldens politicians to make those changes. But I have a theory on how we drive change in the city, and I think it requires a number of things. It requires, underpinning everything is data. You need the data to be able to be looking at where you prioritise, where you can make the difference, how to make the case for things, and then crucially how to tell the stories of success when it works. You need political leadership. We've got that at a mayoral level. And we've got it in many of the boroughs. What's interesting is how you then can then that spreading. And other boroughs are saying, well, why is that happening there? Why is it that my kids or their kids can go safely to school there, or their kids are not breathing in toxic air throughout the whole school day because of the school streets there? That's not fair. That is changing. That pressure comes. You need the technical expertise, and you need your borough, and the boroughs who are willing to do ambitious, bold things tend to attract those officers who think imaginatively and creatively and do some really ambitious stuff. So that becomes a self-fulfilling cycle. But the thing that's often forgotten is the role of campaigning communities in this. This is not just down to the politicians in here. London is very fortunate, and I think some of the success in London can be directly attributed to the communities and campaign groups that have lobbied and asked for change at a repeated level. It isn't always perfect. Taking some of these challenges from a political perspective is often quite a thankless task and can be really quite challenging in some of the public meetings that you get. People are subject to abuse, threats, all sorts of different things. And the campaign groups are absolutely vital for that, so that inboxes don't just hear the opposition to a cycle lane. They don't just hear the opposition to a low-traffic neighbourhood. They say, actually, this is great. We love this. Yeah, or we really like what you've done here, but it's not quite good enough. We'd like to see more. Those comments are so important because it gives people the political will to think, actually, this is great. You couple that with data that adds, well, less bike lanes increased by 100% the number of cyclists, or it's diverse, or this school street has reduced the amount of pollution throughout the whole school day. That data tells the story of success. The individuals, the emotional piece on this, it's okay. Not just statistics. It's absolutely vital you have all of those pieces together. But don't forget, from a politician's perspective, if you've taken a whole load, you've expended a whole load of political capital on putting a bike lane, and then all the cyclists moan to you about it, and all the people who don't want it in the moan to you about it, suddenly, why would you do it again? Yeah. So there is a role for campaigning communities, okay, critical
I think
friendship.
That message is loud and clear, and something that we should talk about at the end. Very, very quickly, before I open up to the online audience, some more questions from the floor. This point about the member of the audience who was saying, why aren't we communicating behaviour change? Why don't we much more articulate what the rules of the road are in London?
So I think we do some. I think putting on the tube probably is not the best place to put it. But if you look at the billboards, the amount of money that we spend on the anti-speeding campaign that's out there at the moment, if you drive down the A12, you look at the back of most buses, there are a lot of buses, there are the messaging out there. Can we do more? Yes, but marketing is exceptionally expensive it doesn't always lead to behaviour change. You tell people about things, but that doesn't lead to behaviour change. In my view, you need a combination of things. You need to change the infrastructure to make the road safer. You need to educate people about how to use that and their responsibilities on that. So the education, the work with schools, the work with trainee, training adults and kids around the city to cycle, and then you need the mass information campaigns. We do all three, both on social media and in the press and on what's called on-street advertising. But obviously, you can't target everywhere, and that is expensive, and you need to choose where you want to put the resources.
Brilliant. Frank, can we have some questions from online? I'm going to try and come back to everyone in the room as well.
So we have 25 questions online.
Can you summarize them?
Summarize them quickly. So there are two questions on liability, like in case of a collision, why not take the rule that the driver is responsible unless he can prove otherwise? Or she, exactly. Then there are two questions. People who are concerned that the space, extra space for cyclists, are going to reduce the space for buses and trams that we also need. So this contradiction or, yeah. And then there is one idea about limiting, why not limiting the speed to 20 miles per hour in the city, and make that with technology automatic in cars. But I think these are actually two questions. One would be the easier part of limiting the speed limit, and then yeah.
Right. Okay. Those are great. And I'm going to take some questions. Some people over here have had their arm up. These two gentlemen just on the left here, one in the blue jumper. That's right.
So there was a landmark ruling today about a small girl that died in Lewisham as a result of air pollution. And Will, you make the point about the data. We've got the data that vehicles are getting heavier, and that electric vehicles particularly are sort of a panacea of, oh, they're going to fix, you know, all the woes of the car. Well, we know that tire pollution and brake dust, it's not really talked about as a massive looming crisis. What legal mechanisms are there to hold boroughs, London and sort of rest of the UK to account? Because it feels like it's this massive crisis that's just not being engaged with right now.
Yeah. Okay, I'm coming over there. You've had your hands up. There's just this man in the front here, and then I'm going to take two over here.
Thanks very much. So this is partly riffing on Julie's point about traffic modelling, for instance, but also Rachel on near misses. How do you navigate situations where decision makers might catastrophize about potential delays to, for instance, bus journeys or police response times, etc., and actually then obstruct active travel schemes, or worse still, ignore the data that we have from, for instance, near misses and subjective safety?
Where are you from?
I'm from Stratford, and actually I came here on the Newham Greenway, Newham's only safe north-south cycle route, which has been closed for 18 months by Thames Water. So
great. Okay, a series of questions. I'm going to come back to other people. But we've got a lot of questions already. I'm not going to try and summarize them. I'm going to leave you just to respond to just to a couple of the points each. Rachel, do you have anything you want to respond to?
I guess just briefly, the question on stricter liability was perhaps the kind of thing that I might have thought Will might say, that it would be good if national government would allow us to do this possibly. I mean, maybe not, you know, I have some ambivalence around stricter liability myself, but that and enforcement, automatic enforcement of 20 are things that, can't just be done by London. So maybe if we want those things, they need to be called for at a national level. On the extra space, I mean, Julie maybe will be talking about that, but the fact that London has to make hard decisions in some cases, not all cases. My office overlooks Marylebone Road, which is nice and wide. I don't know how many metres building to building, but lots of space for cycling infrastructure, but sadly no cycling infrastructure. But the fact that London does often have narrow streets does mean that it has to make some challenging decisions, but that also allows some radicalism, right? Because if you've got endless space, in theory, you know, the problem with complete streets is it's still good to drive. Maybe I'll pause there.
I'm going to pick on the question of speeds and kind of, you know, like making the city 20 miles per hour. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very kind of obvious, solution, and many in the London boroughs already have a borough-wide 20 miles per hour. That's the case of Islington, for instance. But I think instead of looking at, you know, speed limiters, for instance, and working with the car industry to, you know, kind of enforce them, those from the vehicles, I do think we need more actual speed enforcement. And there's a whole campaign from many local authorities, actually, in London, to to decriminalize speed offenses, which sounds really counterintuitive. But if you make it a civil offense, it means that local authorities can actually enforce themselves. So there's a huge campaign around that, so that the police is no longer in charge and local authorities can do that. I think, sadly, the criteria for speed enforcement from the police relies on fatalities on certain locations. So you have to wait for someone to die to literally address the problem. So that's a massive issue. I think that campaign around decriminalizing speed offenses is a really interesting way of potentially increasing speed enforcement.
Great. Marco, I'm going to try you again. Can you hear us?
I can hear you.
Oh!
Great. Can you hear me?
We can hear you very loudly.
Over DeMarco.
Right. I'm not going to ask you to reprise your presentation. I'm afraid we couldn't hear very much of it. But do you want to just talk? Oh dear, didn't you know that? Do you want to just talk particularly about your point about why we should stop talking about road safety?
Well, I think it has been covered by many of the great people in the panel already, is that, but I still hear it in the conversation that we tend to find it nicer to talk about behavior, individual things, instead of the systematic danger in the cars, because it's quite weird to talk about that we have to work with the car industry to limit their cars. We would limit every electrical scooter in every city like that. And somehow we don't dare to impose this on the car industry, which I think is really weird. We would not accept similar kinds of fatalities by any other machine in any other domain of our lives. It's completely ridiculous that we have to wait until 2040 to reach those goals. But two things that I wanted to add to the conversation that happened there is, I think. Well, one is that we should, and Peter Norton wrote a great book about that, so I always love to quote him, that he says, we have to stop seeing speed offenses and any offenses as human errors. They are predictable human errors, so they are species errors. We know that humans cannot travel through a city and be actively on guard every second. So we shouldn't allow them, machines that result in such severe trauma for other people, knowing that people can't do that. So we really need to curb the machine and not. I sometimes say if I would have a coffee machine that kills two people a day, we wouldn't talk about redesigning the kitchen either. It really is about the coffee machine, and we really should not lose that focus. That's one. And the second thing, I really like the conversation about the political support, because I do indeed also think that there is much more political support for these things than we think, but we are not activating the large group of people that benefit from this if we keep talking about it in terms of bikes versus cars. That's not what people care about. We see in Paris that a mayor with a platform on making better cities for everybody actually was re-elected and has a six-year mandate to do stuff. So I think that's one of the things that I want to give to the floor and to the panel and the room. So I think if we manage to talk, for instance, about the importance of the autonomy of children and the fact that all cities of all countries that signed the United Nations Treaty for the Children's Rights, they need to offer cities that can be navigated autonomously by children from the age of 8. And I bet you that if you put this forward in the public debate, you will find 80-90% of the people agreeing with you. So why are we not using those kinds of arguments instead of continuously centering it around the boring thing of cars versus bikes? I think we are doing ourselves a disservice.
That's when I do want to ask Will, but I'm asking now, but then take some more questions about what are your hopes for a new Labour government? Are there other things that you all think are likely to happen, which are going to make a difference? But let's come back.
I'm apolitical, so I'm a
civil servant looking at their manifestos, yes, and things.
I think that having a government that is trying to work with mayors across the country will be a benefit to everybody in those cities, and I definitely welcome that change.
Right. But is there one particular thing that they've said that you think will be, could be a bit of a game changer, or is it not clear yet?
There are a lot of things that are changing, and you can see some of them beginning to filter through in the press over the last few months.
Very good. Right, I'm going to take some questions from over here. This gentleman here in the blue at the end has had his hand up for a long time, and you have in the red as well. And I'll take these three. Go ahead.
Yes, just coming back to the politics. Angela Rayner recently gave the mayor more powers to, reduce the traffic, take the traffic off of Oxford Street. Is this a chance to do greater things, more ambitious things, with the entire West End?
Great. Very clear question about the West End. Maybe the mayor could be using his powers to make great mayoral development corporations all over London. Yes. And then let's start with this man in the red. Go ahead, you first.
Hello, thank you. Ben, you asked very first question of Will about what have you achieved. And we're here at a safety conference, and we heard a lot of inputs, but we didn't hear the outcomes in terms of killed and serious injuries to cyclists. And I think that's because they've gone up. They're not going down to 2041. So please tell us when these cyclists are going to be safer on the road.
Okay, so a question about the West End, a question about cyclists.
Can I come in on the one on cyclists? So I'm not sure if you didn't hear what I did say, but I did say that the data that was recently released, I'm very happy to share it with everybody, saw a 40% fall in cycling fatalities since the baseline, and 30% fall of all fatalities since the baseline. You are seeing a change, and it is getting safer to cycle in London. So thanks for that question. What was the West End?
I'm going to take a few more questions, then we're going to...
Okay, yeah, sure.
Somebody's got the speaker over there.
Just to pick up where Marco left off with regards to human behaviour, I've had too many close calls with... what do you call them? No, the people, I forgot the word.
The pedestrians
jaywalking on me, and I find myself braking hard to avoid collisions. So how do we deter pedestrians from jaywalking on red lights? In China, for example, if you jaywalk on a red light, there is a screen which shows the person who jaywalked on the red light, and everyone can see that. But this is not enough, potentially introducing financial fines or something, I don't know.
Well, I'm interested to see what the panel think of financial fines for pedestrians.
It's really disgusting.
I'm going to take one last one. Have you got your hand up as well? No. You ask it, Annika, and then we'll go to the man in the black sweat T-shirt.
Organizer's privilege. So we're here in a university. This is an event organized by a university. My question to the panelists is, what can universities as organizations, what can staff, what can students do to further this agenda, to promote cycling safety, to reduce road danger, whatever framing we want to use, but what is it? What is the role of universities, or what can it be?
Okay, and then this man, quick question, and then we're gonna turn to the panel for the last round.
Hi there. So mine is a challenge to Will. So what is stopping TfL from designing and implementing the safest schemes? So I look at the Lambeth Bridges scheme. I look at that as, oh, what could have been? No doubt it's gonna be safer, but it's still far from safe. For example, you can't turn right from Horseferry Road to the start of the cycle superhighway that takes you to the safest crossing in West London. So what is stopping TfL from designing the safest schemes possible?
I'm keen to hear from all three of us. So Julie, do you want to respond to some of the questions?
I guess I'll take the easier one, which is about what can universities do. I think it would be good, for universities to promote cycling, as a mode of transport. But I think I want to go back to that idea about capability and motivation. And I think providing the information for people to navigate the city. I think there's nothing worse in terms of a first experience of cycling in London than finding yourself on an A road where there's absolutely zero protection. And I think that's the kind of thing that would put you off, and you would probably never cycle again in London. So I think it's two things. It's about getting the message that the infrastructure is what it is in London, and being quite honest about it, that it is very patchy and very dangerous at times. But the other message is that there is a real joy of cycling, and that it's affordable, that you get fresh air, and that you can get real happiness from it. So I think it's obviously we talk a lot about safety, and it obviously is tainted by, you know, like negative feelings. We do need to also kind of celebrate what cycling does to people in terms of well-being. So I think it's these two things together.
Briefly on pedestrians and cyclists. So pedestrians and cyclists pose very low risks to each other. That's not just based on police injury data. I've also analysed National Travel Survey data that has self-report collisions and injuries. So, you know, I thought it was possible there were a lot of things going unrecorded, but that's not true. You know, the big risk to pedestrians and cyclists is people operating motor vehicles, and therefore I think, you know, bringing in more rules, more restrictions, more stigmatisation of people walking cycling is a terrible idea. And I was very pleased to see that New York City has legalised jaywalking. I don't even like that term. So well done, New York City. And one of the reasons behind this, the push for this, was that 90% of citations in New York City for jaywalking were issued to Black and Latino people. So there was kind of supporting racist enforcement.
Great. I was also going to add that jaywalking doesn't exist in this country as a thing. So it's not it's not legal. It's not illegal in this country.
It's legal.
It's not a crime. It isn't. Just in terms of the West End, I think that's a...
It's not legally a crime.
But it's not a crime in the UK. Just in terms of the West End, I think that's a good example of where a government and cities can work together to bring about change. I think that the changes that are being proposed, and we want to work on Oxford Street, can act as a wider catalyst, not just for the West End, but other areas. We've seen the changes that have happened on high streets around London. If you look at Stoke Newton High Street, where you've got a bus gate come in on there, which provide benefits for buses as well as cycling, people walking, very very clear benefits on that. You look at Aldwych Strand. I should know this. I got married on the road. It's an absolute transformation of the of that area. You can see, you know, the pedestrian, you know, the more better walking and cycling facilities can drive economic growth, and we know how important that is for government, and it's great that they're recognising that actually the role that can play in active travel in terms of driving that economic growth, not just at a regional level, but actually that West End is vitally important for national growth, national economic growth, and maintaining London as an international competitive city. You know, all the schemes, I wish that I had a magic wand and I could solve every scheme and make it perfect for everybody. That isn't the case. I thought that your piece around the numbers, the space that's available in London, there are difficult decisions to be made on things, but I think we always tend to work to try and make them as safe as possible. The piece on universities, I think, is absolutely fundamental, and I think if there's one message I want to send back to this audience and in this location, and I went to this university, and when I went to this university, I was too scared to cycle in London. I walked a lot, but I did. Universities have an absolutely vital role. We've heard of some of the work that Rachel does and other universities do in terms of research. We know some of the campaigning work that students and staff have done through the petition, and that's actually why we're here now after tragic deaths. But universities have a bigger role to play than that, or an additional role to play in that. They are large, important corporate entities in our city. Universities are one of the biggest employers in London. I thought I heard, remind me, it was one in 18 Londoners work at a university. That ranges from professors to cleaners. Yep. That ranges from the fundraisers to the... to the students themselves. It is a huge entity. They are some of the biggest developers in terms of new buildings, in terms of halls of residence, in terms of campuses. They are some of the larger landowners. LSE seems to be expanding every time I come here. It's remarkable. But those things means that these institutions have power. Yep, they have influence. They have a very, very important role to play talking to local boroughs. We talked about the fragmented nature of this. The campaigning communities just can't be the cycling community or the living streets. This needs to come from all areas, from business, from hospitals, from universities. They can play a really significant role. And where universities have spoken up and have articulated and have invested in this, built it into their own plans, you see changes. We've got a brilliant cycle scheme designed for Wood Lane in West London. I don't think that would have been possible without the work of Imperial in terms of not just the staff there and the students there, but actually, you know, but that as a corporate entity. In West London, Brunel University have been working with Hillingdon, which is not a borough people would always shout about in terms of cycling changes, but that's actually delivering a new scheme from West Drayton Station to the university itself. Yeah? So we need, and this is my plea to everybody here who works or attends or studies at a university, please talk to your leadership, yeah, management, the deans, the chairs, I can't remember all the terminology, the vice deans or whatever it is. We need that to be a corporate message for things, because we need campaigning communities. They can play a really important role in influencing the politics and changing some of the behaviour. They can also play a leading role, as I said, themselves in terms of their own investments. But we also need coordination across the universities. It is very, very hard, from my perspective, to reach out to every university. And often we depend on, does anyone know anyone who works at this university, because we've got a consultation up here and they might be interested? Or does anyone know anyone who's involved in here, because we would like to see if that new halls of residence could be connected with it? That's no way to work strategically with one of the biggest sectors in the city. Today, I literally heard, did anyone know that Santander Cycles offer a 25% discount for students and graduates for 5 years after you've graduated university? I was like, well, why can't we tell the universities? And they say, oh, we've tried, but who do we reach in universities? Yeah, yeah. Yep. There is that need for coordination and leadership.
And that nicely sets me up for the fact we have just convened a London's first cross-university network to promote cycling. And I guess this is our first public event, so I'm announcing it now. If you want to know more, there is a form you can sign as you leave. I've been told it's at the doors. Is that right? On the doors. So please, yeah, they're at the back of the room, you'll see on taped to the wall. Please sign up to that, or just email any of us at our academic addresses, and we'll make sure you're connected. But this will be a campaign working across all of London's universities, working with Will, working with the boroughs, working with Sustrans and others to just try and do what Will says, which is really become a voice for safer and more inclusive cycling in London. We have run out of time. I want to begin by apologising to Marco for our tech difficulties. It's really frustrating. Please, he does great work. Do look at his articles, do read his book. There's a new blog, as I said, on the LSE that we're sharing on social media. Thanks to our panelists. I want to send special tribute to Will, who does great work. And, you know, it's a tough job because he's dealing with the harsh reality of road deaths and injuries in London, and it's horrible. And thank you for all your hard work. Thank you to our organisers, particularly colleagues from the Grantham Institute who helped us organise this. And thank you to all of you for coming.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.